Chapter 19. Changing the Dream. The longer I thought about the exploitation of Bolivia by foreign organizations and the role I had played in it as an EHM, the angrier and more depressed I grew. I considered flying back to La Paz, or to Colombia, or to one of the other Spanish-speaking countries, and joining a resistance movement. It struck me that it was what Tom Paine would have done. Then I realized that, rather than use a gun, he would have taken up a pen. I asked myself how I could be most effective. The answer began to materialize during one of my trips with the nonprofit organization that worked in Guatemala. Talking with a Mayan elder, I decided that I needed to return to Ecuador's Shuar territory, where I had lived as a Peace Corps volunteer more than 2 decades earlier. I was, I see now, extremely confused, torn between old loyalties to my EHM colleagues, a guilty conscience, a desire to expose the wrong I had done, and an addiction to that vice that so pervades our society, materialism. Some place in my subconscious lurked the idea that the Shuar could help straighten me out. A friend and the publisher of my books on indigenous cultures, Ehud Sperling, and I took an American Airlines flight to Quito, Ecuador, and a smaller plane down the Andes to Cuenca. We spent a couple of nights in that colonial city, high in the mountains where I had lived following my tour in the rainforest. Then we rented a jeep and driver, left very early in the morning, and wound our way along treacherous mountain roads toward the jungle town of Macas. The trip was spectacular. Descending from the top of the Andes through an endless series of switchbacks, it was the old potholed road I remembered from 2 decades earlier. Sheer cliffs rising on one side, and a deep gorge of cascading water on the other. A few rickety trucks coming up out of the jungle forced us to pull over precariously close either to the rock wall or the drop-off. Otherwise, we had the place to ourselves. It was truly another world, far removed from our lives in the States. I wondered how I had ever managed to make the transition from this to EHM. The simple answer was that back then, a very young and frustrated man who had grown up in rural New Hampshire, I had craved the excitement and money that the profession offered. Like a fish seduced by a shiny lure flashing through the water, I had snatched it. Around noon, our jeep drove into a small community where the road had previously ended. Now it continued on, rougher and muddier, soaked by rains that swept up from the Amazon basin toward the town of Macas. I began to tell Ehud how I had felt when I first visited Macas in 1969. It got us to talking about the role our country has played in world history. The United States exemplified democracy and justice for about 200 years. Our Declaration of Independence and Constitution inspired freedom movements on every continent. We led efforts to create global institutions that reflected our ideals. During the 20th century, our leadership and movements promoting democracy and justice increased. We were instrumental in establishing the Permanent Court of International Justice in The Hague, the Covenant of the League of Nations, the Charter of the United Nations, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and many UN conventions. Since the end of World War II, however, our position as leader has eroded. The model we presented to the world undermined by a corporatocracy hell-bent on empire building. While a Peace Corps volunteer, I was aware that Ecuadorian citizens, as well as those in neighboring nations, were outraged by our brutality and baffled by our overt contradictions in policy. We claimed to defend democracy in places like Vietnam. At the same time, we ousted and assassinated democratically elected presidents. High school students throughout Latin America understood that the United States had overthrown Chile's Allende, Iran's Mossadegh, Guatemala's Arbenz, Brazil's Goulart, and Iraq's Qasim, even if our own students were unaware of such things. Washington's policies transmitted a confusing message to the world. Our actions undercut our most hallowed ideals. One way the corporatocracy exerted control was by empowering autocratic governments in Latin America during the 1970s. These governments experimented with economic policies that benefited U.S. investors and international corporations, and generally ended in failure for local economies. Recessions, inflation, unemployment, and negative economic growth. Despite mounting opposition, Washington praised the corrupt leaders who were bankrupting their nations while amassing personal fortunes. To make matters worse, the United States supported right-wing dictators and their death squads in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Nicaragua. A wave of democratic reform swept the continent in the 1980s. Newly elected governments turned to the experts at the IMF and the World Bank for solutions to their problems. Persuaded to adopt SAPs, they implemented unpopular measures ranging from privatization of their utilities to cuts in social services. They accepted outrageously large loans that were used to develop infrastructure projects that all too often served only the upper classes while leaving the country burdened with debt. The results were disastrous. Economic indicators tumbled to new depths. Millions of people once hailed as members of the middle class lost their jobs and joined the ranks of the impoverished. As citizens watched their pensions, healthcare, and educational institutions decline, they also noticed that their politicians were buying up Florida real estate rather than investing in local businesses. The communist movements of the 1950s and 1960s never took hold, except in Castro's Cuba. However, a new wave of resentment against the corporatocracy and its corrupt Latin collaborators swept the continent. Then, less than a year before Ehud and I headed to Ecuador, the first Bush administration made a decision that had a lasting negative impact on United States-Latin American relations. The president ordered the armed forces to invade Panama. It was an unprovoked, unilateral attack to unseat a government, ostensibly because it refused to renege on the Panama Canal Treaty. The invasion killed more than 2,000 innocent civilians and sent waves of fear across every country south of the Rio Grande. The fear soon turned to anger. I mulled these things over and discussed them with Ehud on that drive to Macas. I asked him if he thought there could be any alternative to the corruption that plagued the continent. Of course there is, he assured me. Critical mass. That's all you need. He asked how I had journeyed to Macas in those days, given that the road had not gone that far. You could slosh through the jungle for weeks, or you could take a stopwatch flight on an old World War II Army surplus DC-3. That flight seemed almost suicidal, but it's what I did. Stopwatch flight? Those planes couldn't make it over the top of the Andes. They had to follow the river valleys. No radar. The pilot never knew when clouds would sock him in, so as soon as he left the ground, he clicked on a stopwatch. After 30 seconds, he took a 10-degree turn to the right. After another 45 seconds, a 15-degree bank to the left. Pretty scary. Lost a lot of planes in those days. But it was better and safer than trekking through the jungle. So they built the road. He paused. Why? His arched eyebrows gave me the clue. Critical mass? Exactly. People had demanded change. When the clamoring reached a certain level, it happened. In this case, that change had been on the side of commercial development opening up the Amazon basin. I knew that the critical mass had been heavily influenced by oil companies. Entering Macas, I saw that the road had transformed a sleepy jungle outpost into a bustling boomtown. Yet I could speculate that as more and more of us became aware of the threats to our future, the critical mass may shift to projects that emphasize peace and sustainability. We checked into a hotel that had a couple of items I had never seen before in this part of the world, a flush toilet and shower. The latter greatly amused Ehud because of the electrical outlet next to the faucet. For electric shavers, I assured him. To execute yourself, he replied. The next morning, we boarded a small plane. Ehud asked the pilot about the stopwatch. My uncle used one, the pilot grinned. But I got radar. The plane deposited us on a mud runway deep in the forest. A cluster of Shuar men were assembled at the edge of the clearing. They looked pretty much as I remembered them. Muscular, buff, laughing, happy people, except now they wore old T-shirts and Dacron shorts the missionaries insisted they used to combat the sin of nudity. As they unloaded supplies that had arrived with us, an old man approached me. When I announced my interest in helping his people save their jungle from destruction, he reminded me that my culture, not his, was causing the problems. "The world is as you dream it," he told me. "Your people dreamed of huge factories, tall buildings, as many cars as there are raindrops in this river. Now you begin to see that your dream is a nightmare." I asked what I could do to help.
"That's simple," he replied.
"All you have to do is change the dream. You need only plant a different seed. Teach your children to dream new dreams." Over the next few days, we heard similar messages from other members of the community. Both Ehud and I were impressed with the wisdom of these people and their determination to protect their environment and culture. After I returned to the United States, I set in motion procedures for creating an organization dedicated to altering the way we in industrialized countries see the Earth and our relationship to it. I did not realize it at the time, but I was endeavoring to reverse the process I had promoted as an EHM. Eventually, we named the nonprofit corporation Dream Change, in recognition of the message delivered to me that day in Shuar territory. Through it, we organized trips and workshops. We took people to live with indigenous teachers, and we brought those teachers to the United States. We produced books, tapes, CDs, and films aimed at bridging the gaps between these two worlds. The Pachamama Alliance, another nonprofit, was formed as a result of one of our trips. It has raised millions of dollars to help indigenous communities, much of it used to finance legal battles against oil companies. Thanks to my experience with Kobe, I had launched myself on a new career. Throughout the 1990s and into the early years of the new millennium, I traveled frequently to Latin America. I spent most of the time there with indigenous people in the Amazon and the Andes. I was deeply impressed by their commitment to environmental stewardship and a spirituality that surpassed anything I witnessed among the world's major religions. These people appeared determined to make the world a better place. As a Pachamama Alliance board member, I also met with lawyers, politicians, and oil company employees. It was over dinner with such a group one night in Quito that I first learned about Venezuela's Hugo Chavez. The oil company representatives despised this fiery military officer who founded the anti-corporatocracy Fifth Republic movement, but the politicians had to admire his charisma. My indigenous friends were encouraged that his ancestors were Indian and African as well as Spanish, that he continually lambasted the wealthy, and promised to help the poor to better lives. Chapter 20. Venezuela's Chavez. Chavez's rise to fame began in February 1992, when, as lieutenant colonel in the Venezuelan army, he led a coup against Carlos Andrés Pérez. The president, whose name had become synonymous with corruption, angered Chavez and his followers because of his willingness to sell his country to the World Bank, the IMF, and foreign corporations. Largely as a result of Caracas's collaboration with the corporatocracy, Venezuelan per capita income had plummeted by more than 40%, and what had previously been the largest middle class in Latin America sank into the ranks of the impoverished. Chavez's coup failed, but it set the stage for his future political career. After he was captured, he was allowed to appear on national television to persuade his troops to cease hostilities. He defiantly declared to his nation that he had failed por ahora, for now. His courage catapulted him to national fame. He served 2 years in Yare prison. During that time, Pérez was impeached. Chavez emerged with a reputation for boldness, integrity, a commitment to helping the poor, and a determination to smash the shackles of foreign exploitation that had enslaved his country and his continent for so many centuries. In 1998, Hugo Chavez was elected president of Venezuela with an impressive 56% of the vote. Once in office, he did not bow to corruption like so many before him. Instead, he honored men like Guatemala's Arbenz, Chile's Allende, Panama's Torrijos, and Ecuador's Roldós. They had all been assassinated or overthrown by the CIA. Now, he said, he would follow in their footsteps, but with his own vision and charismatic personality, and the staying power endowed on the leader of a country overflowing with oil. His victory and his continued defiance of Washington and the oil companies inspired millions of Latin Americans. Chavez kept his commitments to the poor, urban and rural. Instead of reinjecting profits into the oil industry, he invested them in projects aimed at combating illiteracy, malnutrition, diseases, and other social ills. Rather than declaring huge dividends for investors, he helped Argentina's embattled President Kirchner buy down that nation's IMF debts of more than $10 billion, and he sold discounted oil to those who could not afford to pay the going price, including communities in the United States. He earmarked a portion of his oil revenues for Cuba, so it could send medical doctors to impoverished areas around the continent. He forged laws that consolidated the rights of indigenous people, including language and land ownership rights, and fought for the establishment of Afro-Venezuelan curricula in public schools. The corporatocracy saw Chavez as a grave threat. Not only did he defy oil and other international companies, but also he was turning into a leader others might try to emulate. From the Bush administration's perspective, two intransigent heads of state, Chavez and Hussein, had evolved into nightmares that needed to end. In Iraq, subtle efforts, both the EHMs and the Jackals, had failed, and now preparations were underway for the ultimate solution: invasion. In Venezuela, the EHMs had been replaced by Jackals, and Washington hoped that they could solve the problem. Using tactics perfected in Iran, Chile, and Colombia, Jackals sent thousands of people into the streets of Caracas on April 11, 2002, marching toward the headquarters of Venezuela's state-owned oil company and on to Miraflores, the presidential palace. There they met pro-Chavez demonstrators who accused their organizers of being pawns of the U.S. CIA. Then suddenly and unexpectedly, the armed forces announced that Chavez had resigned as president and was being held at a military base. Washington celebrated, but the jubilation was short-lived. Soldiers loyal to Chavez called for a massive counter-coup. Poor people flooded into the streets, and on April 13, Chavez resumed his presidency. Official Venezuelan investigations concluded that the coup was sponsored by the U.S. government. The White House practically admitted to culpability. The Los Angeles Times reported, quote, "Bush administration officials acknowledged Tuesday that they had discussed the removal of Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez for months with military and civilian leaders from Venezuela," unquote. Ironically, the 2003 invasion of Iraq was a boon to Chavez. It sent oil prices skyrocketing. Venezuela's coffers filled. Suddenly, drilling for the heavy crude oils of the country's Orinoco region became feasible. Chavez announced that when the price of oil reached $50 a barrel, Venezuela, with its abundance of heavy crude, surpassed the entire Middle East as the world's number one repository of petroleum. His analysis, he said, was based on U.S. Department of Energy projections. The rest of Latin America watched closely to see how the Bush administration would deal with Chavez after the failed coup attempt against him. What they witnessed was a cowed U.S. president. The White House realized that it had to tread carefully. Venezuela was our second largest supplier of petroleum and petroleum products, fourth largest supplier of crude. Its oil fields were much closer than those of the Middle East. Through its ownership of Citgo, Venezuela impacted many American workers, drivers, and a multitude of corporations that sell to or buy from Citgo. In addition, Caracas had been our ally in breaking the OPEC oil embargoes of the 1970s. The Bush administration's options for military intervention were limited by the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the Israeli-Palestinian debacle, the growing unpopularity of the royal family in Saudi Arabia, political problems in Kuwait, and a militarized Iran. Luis Inácio Lula da Silva's 2002 landslide victory in Brazil further bolstered nationalistic movements. A founder of the Progressive Workers' Party in 1980, Lula was a politician with a long history of advocating social reform, demanding that Brazil dedicate its natural resources to helping the poor, and insisting on audits for Brazilian debts to the IMF that he claimed were illegal. In winning the election with more than 60% of the vote, Lula joined Chavez as one of the continent's new wave of living legends. Word spread to the most remote villages at the top of the Andes and deep into the rainforests that those previously considered as disenfranchised were coming into power. Latin Americans took heart. For the first time in recent history, they saw the opportunity to slip out from under the U.S. yoke of domination. Two countries were especially influenced by the successes of Chavez and Lula. They too had large indigenous populations, and they possessed oil and gas resources coveted by the corporatocracy. They were also countries where I had strong and very personal connections. Ecuador and Bolivia.